after the outbreak of hostilities, we all had to register for the draft, and it became apparent to me I had to make a decision. I was offered a commission in the Navy to work in the supply area, and it prompted, of course, a decision as to whether I should ask for exemption or not. So I went to the draft board and indicated that I had a commission and had to decide whether to go into the service or remain in industry. And so and like their decision, so they undertook to study it and then decided that I felt with my background that I ought to remain in industry, that it was essential health care and my knowledge of the field that I would be of value there. So I made that decision and therefore was deferred for the entire war period.
So do I recall that McNeil actually was one of the groups that, the companies that produced penicillin during the war?
Yes, well, we had, let's say, been active with the sulfonamides, which were the predecessor for infection, and also for burn treatment. And consequently, we were one of the first to distribute penicillin. We didn't actually have the tanks to make it. We worked with one of the producers, Hayden Chemical,
okay,
who had a plant in Penn's Neck, New Jersey. And we were the one of their outlets for that part of the production which would be used for, we did some clinical experiments with the original material as well as distribution later for civilian health use, of course, to hospitals. And of course, one reason we were selected was that we were then providing pharmaceutical products for the medical profession.
Interesting. So I'm a little unclear about what are the therapeutic uses of sodium butasol. Was that used mostly for people who were emotionally upset, or was it also a war material, so to speak?
No, it had general use as a daytime sedative. It could, the use could be very easily summarized. It didn't have the hypnotic effects of secobarbital, and it did not, it was metabolized in the body so that it did not have the concerns of phenobarbital, which was also used occasionally in daytime sedation, but would accumulate in the body and was toxic over a period of time, even leading to deaths. So that the fact that it was metabolized in the body meant it was very valuable for the physician's use. And much safer than phenobarbital.
So this is a sedative for people who had pains, or?
Pains, as you indicated, depression, and situations where an individual was upset, irritable, due to factors, might be death, calamity, situations with youngsters, but also to induce sleep on a gradual basis without being a hypnotic. The disadvantage is, of course, of a hypnotic is the sudden onset of sleep. I mean, it can be dangerous if used during the daytime. Mm-hmm. For instance, machinery, one person, you know, they can very easily, you know, damage themselves in one way or another, hands, feet, driving an automobile. So, you know, it had broad use, and the niche that we developed for it was recognized by physicians, and that's why it became the largest brand barbiturate on the market. And when I say brand, just to distinguish brand from generic. Mm-hmm. And while Johnson & Johnson and McNeil Pharmaceutical no longer offer it, it and a derivative, butyrbarbital, are still being used.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the newer products in the last 10, 15 years are products like Halcyon and a whole series of benzo derivatives.
So would you say that McNeil was a stronger company after World War II, or was there some sort of readjustment period that you had to go through?
Well, there's no question that, yes, we continued to grow and expand, and this offering products for prescription use or physician's use only. We no longer did anything in the surgical dressings or the lines that pre-1938, and therefore after the war it became necessary to expand our physical facilities, which we did at 17th and Cambria, and in 1946 we bought a new plant.
So this was kind of the background, though you didn't know it at the time, for Tylenol, for the development of Tylenol.
Well, very much so, because it was during this period that we built up our research department to include pharmacologists, organic chemists in the, what we call the Division of Medical Sciences under Dr. Kay. I'll spell the name later. Jim Cade, who is a Carleton University of Illinois doctorate, under Dr. Rose there, come to think of it, and the medical group under Dr. James Schaefer, S-H-A, well, I'll catch spelling, who was head of what I call the Division of Medical Sciences and then the Division of Clinical Investigation, as Dr. Schaefer's area. And they worked together, but as you imagine, the medical side undertook all clinical investigation. And pharmaceutical development was under Dr. Cade, along with organic.
So did Cade go ahead and hire lots of Illinois graduates? Or
Jim had been in the industry, so that while we were particularly interested in the Illinois group for another reason, he had a broad view, and we didn't necessarily try to get recent graduates. We wanted someone with experience in industry, but he built up a small, effective group. And once we had the new plant, which gave them laboratory facilities, it was three times the old plant. So I had an opportunity to design the labs to, so that they were, while we didn't have many, they were specific for their use and therefore very effective use of space. Then drew in, you see, in a similar way, some other physicians that do clinical work, expanded the sales force, even though most of them were on the outside, didn't require a lot of space. But this was a threefold expansion at 17th and Cambria.
So what was your title at that point? Because your dad was still...
My title must have been vice president. But title didn't mean much because my father was a graduate of the Wharton School and wasn't involved at all. I had her own responsibility.
Well, what about your brother? Was he?
Well, my brother Henry was an applied economic science major at Yale and came in, and it was evident to him that his area and by nature and disposition, he was sales minded and therefore had an opportunity to develop the sales program with those that were there to better prepare our sales representatives to sell to the physician prescription products, which means, of course, detailing the physician so that he would write prescriptions which would be filled in the drugstore, and then through wholesale channels we would supply the drugstore. And we had several discussions about roles, and he, because he wondered whether there was a place for him, and I, of course, assured him that there was need to develop the sales side as much as the scientific.
Right.
And I also had production and finance, but that, we had capable people there, so that. But I did the budgets for everybody at that young age.
Now, was there a board?
Well, there were four owners. My father, mother, who wasn't active, my brother, and I was, of course, the fourth. So it was very much a family business, and run as such. And while we had our chief financial officer, who was also a vice president, Jim Newton, and the woman, Jim accepted, let's say, this family operation and was most cooperative, extremely helpful to me, because I developed new ways of cost accounting of the pharmaceutical products, which they never had, in order to know whether or not we were getting enough sales volume out of a particular product for the time spent by the detail men and advertising costs, and factoring that in with the cost of manufacturing, time on tablet machines that was coded all the way through the handling. Now, which was a revelation, of course, to them because they never had that sort of approach before in selling products to the
physician. Where did you pick up that kind of knowledge?
Experience. I went to the College of Pharmacy to understand, you know, what a pharmacist knows, but then I soon found that manufacturing is quite different, and you had to take a lot of background and develop, let's say, the economics of producing and manufacturing, which covered the fields I just mentioned, and but that was some of the fundament. Being able to do it.
Right.
And
it
ended up,
jack of all trades.
Well, I ended up heading a course in 1938 in manufacturing at the College of Pharmacy. I was an adjunct professor.
Right. And you taught at Temple also, right?
Well, that was later.
Oh, okay.
When the war came along, I had to give up that. But I had, I was there 38, 39, 40, 41, 4 years. I had, they assigned me a junior professor to do all the lab work and to spend all the time, and all I did was organize and lecture so that I didn't have to go out there. I didn't have the time, of course, to spend out there. but it worked out well. It was a graduate course,
mm-hmm.
where and one or two of the bright seniors could elect for it. Having had that experience at Yale, I did the same thing there once
right.
I was
right.
We had some bright young fellows that wanted to go into manufacturing. That had enough of an introduction so that they could get good positions.
So where should we start the Tylenol story?
Well, the Tylenol story really begins with our experience with Budesol and niche marketing, where we understood what the market was, and being a small company, we concentrated on those features which would enable us to achieve success in marketing. And so the background, and we also, I should say, had an elixir of Budesol, which was the only elixir of its type on the market of barbiturates. And this was an ingenious development that I and a pharmaceutical chemist devised, whereby we had low alcohol, but we had a solvent base which would hold the drug in the elixir, hold it from hydrolyzing, because the barbiturate hydrolyzing, you lose the strength, it'd break down. And we had a stable elixir. And we didn't have a patent on it. We didn't divulge. In those days, we didn't have to divulge on the label what it was, so that eventually we had some people that copied it. But that was a big seller. That was the real product.
How did people take barbiturates before that?
Well, tablets and capsules.
Uh-huh.
Injections were only really for the hypnotic group. But tablet and capsule was the big volume. But for many people, we had low doses for pediatric use, but for many people they preferred, you see, taking it by mouth, and the physician has the assurance when you take it and swallow it, you see, that it's going to go down and be absorbed. And not taking a pill and having flipping it out, you know, and
uh-huh.
You know, also there's some practical reasons for, and this was elixir Budesol sodium was the star of the group, and of course, as a, you might say, a forerunner, precursor to Tylenol, we had a few other products where we had used the same principle. We called them liquids, where we either suspended active ingredients or made them into a form which was palatable, and even made the first emulsion of castor oil. In those days, castor oil was used way back in 1938. So that we had experience with liquid presentations, you might say, liquid dosage form, and recognize that being a small company, if we coordinate our efforts, and this meant with sales, advertising, with the marketing side working with us, and the production side, that we could do a good economic job with specialties. But I might add that when you market in the prescription drug field, you have only limited time with a physician to detail him, and therefore you only can spend time really on one product, and you may leave a sample or literature or some sort, and you might mention the other two, but in our advertising programs, we would have to select only three out of our list, which I showed you last week, you know, was a long list.
Mm-hmm.
But we could only do three in a period, and we then set up nine advertising periods, and we would have three products in each one for the sales representative. But it also meant coordination with production and everything else to produce the product, and then that coordination led to a committee management and to re-examining all the functions in order to coordinate and expedite. And this way, as a small company, we can move faster and do things in some with a greater cooperation than any of the big companies.
So this is the new products committee?
Well, we had an executive committee. I had an executive committee, but then we had sales and advertising committee, which my brother headed, which had, as its name implies, the head of sales, the head of advertising, the head of market research, you see, with him coordinating their activity. And over on the other side, I headed a production research and production committee, which coordinated research, which in that side was pharmaceutical development, with production, and control division, which was independent, you see, function there. And so I had that area also, but it meant if we wanted to advertise and promote in a certain time period, why...
Had to have the product ready.
The product was made, but also samples were made. Remember, mm-hmm. You had to have samples for them, and we gave production credit for making them, so they got credits for everything they did, and they knew about this new system of cost control and accounting.
See, and you did this without the MBAs, the Harvard MBAs advising you?
No Harvard MBAs at that point, no. They recognized their value, but we were, no, it was just impractical. In those early days, later we had them, and, got more sophisticated, but that is why I mentioned to you in that draft the study of function and operation and how we organize the committees and in turn use them very effectively and efficiently, you see, to get cooperation and to produce, frankly, at lower cost than we had before. And my father just smiled, and the chief financial officer was quite pleased because it worked at that level, at that size, as a small company.
So it sounds like you were the idea man, at least in the case of Tylenol, when you met
Let's say that I worked with the research and clinical group on all their products, but they initiated their program and they directed the work with their own staff. I didn't, with their division meetings with organic chemists, pharmacologists, pharmaceutical development people, they did all of that planning work, you see, but ideas that would come up for new products had to go through the new products committee to be certain that the sales group were going to sell them if we were going to spend a lot of time and effort. If I've conveyed the way it worked, and it didn't work.
So, What about the, what's it called, the Institute for the Study of Analgesic and Sedative Drugs?
Well, as you gathered from my background, I had encouraged, I had attended scientific groups. I was a journalist, but I would go to meetings of the chemical group, pharmaceutical group, and industry groups, and as did others, to get ideas and to make contacts and further our program. And we had consultants in every field of research and development and medical. We had the best people in Philadelphia as consultants in the medical, individuals who, because they felt that it was, let's say, part of their duty to render consultation. This was when they took the oath, they felt that they should do it, but they were not ones that would go to a pharmaceutical company because they were in the academic field and felt above it. So we had as consultant people that were more expert, if I may say so, I'll qualify this, but than the people, the medical people in the companies at that stage.
These guys were at the research front, that's the word we use, the euphemism.
And I'll give an example. Bob Dritz, who was head of the pulmonary anesthesiology at Penn, but who was the co-author of the textbook on anesthesiology, Dritz, Eckenhoff, and Van Dam, which is still today the textbook, but he reorganized anesthesiology so that when the surgeon was operating, he no longer took care of the patient. And this was, Rodden was head of surgery, and he gladly gave Bob Dritz the responsibility for maintaining the patient through the operation into recovery. And intensive care was on him. And Bob Dritz happened to be one of my closest friends, but the point is he was a consultant. Julius Conwell was a consultant, who was another one that was equally brilliant, PhD MD at Penn.
So did you retain them with some sort of retaining fee?
Yes. Mm-hmm. George Coley was another. George was a distinguished professor of pharmacology at Penn. In my age, I'd known him from pharmacy circles, original. But George was, but we had people of that stature in the different specialties, but also in organic chemistry and the sciences. So that was another reason why, with a small group, we could efficiently, effectively, you see, achieve results. All of this is, you see, a forerunner. So when Tylenol came along, you want me to go into that? So that let's say we were aware of the work that was reporting the literature regarding acetanilid, you see, along the way, showing up with methemoglobin patients, the FDA's concern about toxicity, the unfortunate Massengill deaths from their 51, I'll check that number, deaths from taking elixir of sulfonylamine, and the let's say reactions of everyone that had responsibility for drugs in Washington and the legislators, which led to the banning of acetanilid as a drug for over-the-counter products such as BC headache powder and the rest, in 38, we were aware of the study of metabolism and the development and maturity of pharmacology consisting of pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics, and I'll define those later rather than take the time now, but
I just want to look the table.